Welcome to our session on group self-pronoid annuitization and how to make it popular. We have two speakers here with us today. Firstly, my name's John Nichols, the chair for the session, and we'll be hearing from Aaron Minney and Chow Chow. So Aaron is the head of retirement income research for Challenger. In this role, he's responsible for generating additional research in the areas of decumulation, portfolio construction, investment strategy, retirement risk mitigation, new product solutions and policy support. Has over 20 years' experience as an investment analyst and researcher across a wide range of asset classes. Had previous roles with Colonial First State Global Asset Management, IAG and Macquarie. Has been responsible for the evaluation and strategic development of investment capability. Has been portfolio manager of $5.5 billion of Australian dollar fixed interest, a diversified fund portfolio manager, tactical asset allocation strategist, and an economist. He's been a CFA since 2003, a fellow of the Financial Services Institute of Australia, and is a holder of the Retired Management Analyst designation. He's also on the editorial board of JASA. Also speaking is Chow Chow. He's an actuarial consultant currently at PwC, advises clients mainly in the insurance industry. Over the years, Chow has maintained a keen interest in retirement product development in Australia. Prior to that, Chow worked in the financial services and superannuation sectors. He's a fellow of the Actuaries Institute and a chartered enterprise risk actuary. He's graduated from the University of New South Wales for first class honours in actuarial studies. His honours thesis, Managing Systematic Mortality Risk with Group Self-Pooling and Annuitisation Schemes, was recently published in the Journal of Risk and Insurance, and currently is a member of Council and Secretary of the Banking Practice Committee. So with that, over to Aaron to get things underway.
Okay, well, thanks, John, and thanks, everyone, for coming along this morning. Talking to a room largely full of actuaries, I'll appreciate you've probably all read the fine print at the bottom of the slide. And I'll just note that this is the work I've been doing with Chow, and while I do head up a research function at Challenger, it doesn't necessarily represent the views of either Challenger or PwC, and in that any errors belong to me except for those that I blame on Chow. So what I'll do is step through a range of things that we want to talk about here, looking at the problem of the group self-annuitisation. It's a bit of a flavour of the month at the moment on innovating retirement product. The good thing is, you would have heard with Chow's honours thesis, he started this a few years ago, so he was ahead of the curve on this. But what we want to step through is looking at the products, the concepts of the GSA, and what we're specifically looking at in this paper that we're presenting today, some of the design concepts around that, and then I'll hand over to Chow, and he will take you through the modelling and the results. And then there's some thoughts about some further work that can still be done in this space. I gather most of you are familiar with what this diagram is. It's been lifted out of the final report for financial system inquiry. I think one of the key things to think about this is if you look at the report, and it was highlighting the need to put things in the middle. You know, most of the solutions we've got now are highly flexible, which are great for retirees. Flexibility is a feature that they want, but lack risk management features and potentially high income. In the definition, and taking here the definition that the Australian government actually used, is income being the income distributed through retirement. Now, they put annuities down in the bottom right corner as you look at it, covering the risk management side of things. And what we're doing today is thinking about those products that actually should generate high income. So they're not necessarily as flexible as an account-based pension. They don't cover all the risks that you're going to get if you've got a fully guaranteed lifetime annuity, but they're going to provide higher income in expectation. You know, maybe there's some of the risk management that's pushing in a little bit here, so it's not right in the corner, but the concept of the GSA here is a product that's going to lift up the income so that someone can enjoy more of their lifestyle throughout retirement. And that's the sort of concept of how it sits to complete the triangle, as it were. Here's a list of the products that's sort of out there at the moment, starting with those that are in place at the moment at the top. We have account-based pensions, which is the bulk, lifetime annuities, as I recognise is a small but growing market, We have a tiny market in variable annuities. Nothing yet, though, in deferred annuities. Nothing yet, really, in a ruined contingent lifetime annuity. There's a bit of that in some of the variable annuities that are there. And lastly, group self-annuitisation, which is a concept that has been talked about a lot, but is yet to really have a product in that space. And I can see David sitting in there with the... I haven't listed the lifetime plus. We did run out of room here, David, but kept it to a category in terms of how that sits there, and that's certainly a good innovation there. What we want to talk about today, though, is not the first five in that or even David's product, but what the concept is around a group self-annuitised product. In simple terms, it's something that just has no guarantee, you know, so there's no capital. You know, but by having no guarantee, then you don't have the benefits of the guarantee either. But it's designed to protect against the idiosyncratic risk. And hopefully, you know, that doesn't need too much explanation, but in simple terms, when you have a pool of people, you know, particularly a pool of retirees that sort of face their length of life, there's going to be a distribution of how long each of them is going to live. For any one in particular retiree, they really have no idea whether they'll be the guy who lasts only to 66 or the guy who's still alive 105, or the bunch that all die around 89. When you get a pool of people together, whoever's managing that pool has a much stronger idea of roughly how many are going to go to 66 and how many are going to go to the end. So by pooling, you can generate, you can reduce this idiosyncratic risk. Doesn't mean, you know, you've got to get the systematic risk is still there. You know, certainly the investment risk, as we see down the bottom, is not taken care of, or not automatically taken care of. But by putting the pool together of one form or another, we can get rid of what is known as the idiosyncratic risk. And we want to see how that really can come through. The key advantage of this, of course, is higher expected payments. Because what you're doing when you've pooled this risk is you've got everyone's capital together. Once someone who has passed away at, say, 67, 68, they don't need any more income. And, you know, I feel like I am preaching to the converted here, talking about mortality credits to a room of actuaries. But that mortality credit coming through will generate a higher expected payment, you know, depending on how it's all set up. Now, I did have to get some math into this, you know, but we've kept it fairly simple. And when you're thinking about the way the GSA should work, and you recalculate this every year, is that the income payment, an income is something that the retiree basically receives in, you know, not necessarily an investment return or anything like that. The income payment is just going to be the balance that is there, either that they have or that the fund has, depending on how you want to look at that, and divide that by an annuity factor. Now, calculation of annuity factor is straightforward once you have your mortality tables, once you have your rates of return, and you can figure out how much income you should be paying, you know, the fund or the actuary, whoever's running the GSA would need to update this factor every year, every time there's a payment, but it's something that's fairly straightforward to do. Clearly the change in balance that you're going to get is going to be your return, plus any mortality credit that gets paid, which we'll get to in a second, less any income that's paid back out. So again, nice bit of simple math we can all do on a spreadsheet. Yeah, the impact here of the mortality credit is simply that on death, the balance is effectively paid into the pool. So that what you had, what the deceased member of the pool had, goes back in and shared amongst everyone else. And so for simplicity, we're ignoring any sort of death payment or death benefit early in the stage of a GSA. I think that's something that with our own product and even the Mercer one, it deals with having a death benefit up front for the issues there. Yes, it reduces some of those mortality credits, but it goes to so few, it doesn't make a big difference. Yeah, from a modelling point of view, we've just ignored that for now. But we do face the hurdles. And on two sides here, thinking supply and demand, yeah, or member and design, yeah, one of the biggest hurdles we've got is outside of a room of actuaries, a lot of people are not going to be aware of what a GSA or a group self-annuitisation product is actually going to do. You know, and when you explain it that they give it all back up, the bequest motive is going to come in as a hurdle for many people in this space. So understanding how that fits together, dealing with the bequest motive, having some concern around flexibility, you know, which, you know, it's the reason why the account-based pension is still popular. Flexibility is everywhere there. And simply then the awareness and availability. Hopefully, We get through the phase, and there is, following the FSI, we do see more innovation. We'll see more products in this space. The awareness will become a lot better. The other challenge then becomes the supply side. You know, what investment strategy do you assume? And is your pool open or closed? Most of the work we've seen so far has assumed the pools are closed and that it's a trivial matter to open them up, this point itself is something we looked at in a fair bit of detail in the modelling, and Chow is going to show the results of what happens between open and closed pools here. And the other side is the investment strategy. In effect, what we've called a cash strategy, which is actually asset matched, is one where there's no risk taken on the investment side or as little risk as possible. The alternative is one where you essentially invest in a balance fund. So those familiar with the AGA paper would recognise that they had a balance fund of risky investments earning a high rate of return. So in that sense there, your higher expected income came not just from the higher mortality from the mortality credits from the pooling, but also from a higher expected rate of return. The question is, can you have, two by two, does all four elements of the box work? And so this is sort of what we considered when we had a look at the modelling here to see, well, how would we actually get this up and running in practice? In the design, there are also some complexities we need to think about. Adverse selection. Yeah, one of the first things that an actuary will think about when they're setting an annuity policy is what's the pool of lives that I'm going to experience. We're yet to see how that plays out in a lot of the GSA modelling out there, so demonstrate what that's like. Consideration of choice. The Australian superannuation system is built around the concept of choice. We're just in the middle of seeing the UK system move from a compulsion into one involving a bit of choice. I don't think you could think about having a retirement solution here that wasn't centred and understood fully the impact of choice and what that has in the modelling there. And then lastly, we'll step through the risk-free versus diversified portfolios and open or closed pools. Now, just a quick recap for those that aren't familiar with the literature, and you can probably read this as well as what I can, but in a sense, when you're thinking about adverse selection, the previous work has shown actually a GSA should have less adverse selection than an annuity. There's a bit of thinking around that there. Have a look at the Valdez paper, which is in there. And the other side is that when you look at an optimal strategy, a GSA actually fitted into the optimal mix, and this is the Harnival paper from a couple of years ago, which showed that having a GSA alongside an account-based pension, alongside a lifetime annuity, provided a better mix than either 100% annuitisation or 100% account-based pension. So there's a role to play. And then lastly, Shao's paper with Mike Sherris, looking at you need at least 1,000 members in there for it to work, probably even more. Looked at the mortality improvement on that side, and that the ideal is to get the open pool. If you've got the open pool with a range of ages there, you'll have much more efficient pricing. So in a sense, that's the ideal of what you're trying to achieve. Again, GSA-like products should give a better outcome and provide higher incomes, which is the new field on AGA. If we touch then on the first concept and just think about the adverse selection. GSA modelling so far, it's just assumed it's the whole population. If you look at most of the stuff there, let's take the population mortality, this is the payment you get, everyone's happy. But we know it's not going to happen in a choice environment. And I'll put this one up, because the lung cancer ads on the cigarette packets are really, really disgusting. Yeah, so I highlight that actually the good choice is not to smoke. But the reality is the smokers who don't necessarily make a good choice at the younger ages, and those that are quite sick, and think of the example here of a 65-year-old smoker with lung cancer and sort of a host of other issues, even with a higher income of the GSA, they're not likely to take it on. So if you're going to be offering one of these products, you need to know that there's some slice of the market that's not going to take it on there. And given that, where does it actually end up? Now, to do that, we need to get a bit of the modelling. So I'll hand over to Chow, who's done all the hard work on this, and sit down and let him do some talking.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Aaron. So we know that smokers aren't going to take this up because if they die early, they give everyone else their money. So if you're thinking about selling one of those GSAs, you'd be worried in that how should I price it such that I give everyone a fair price. So what if I assume my mortality distribution to be population mortality and I end up getting select mortality? So this is a very classic question for all annuities, not just GSAs. And we'll show you what happens. So this happens. From here on, I'll tell you how to read this graph. So on the vertical axis, you have the annual income per $100 worth of upfront distribution. Then you've got those boxes and whiskers. In this graph, you can't really see them properly because it's really tight. You've got the 5th percentile down here. You've got the 95th percentile up there. And then there's a mean and a median and a first and a third quartiles. I'll go to that explanation in further graphs. But in this graph, we're seeing... In this graph, we're seeing a GSA assuming population mortality but getting select mortality. And we see that you almost certainly will run out of money in terms of if you're a member, your income every year will almost certainly decline. And so that's an important lesson for funds trying to offer this product. Now, here is another example of adverse selection. We know that a GSA will only protect against idiosyncratic risk. That is, if you happen to live longer than everyone else in your cohort, you're protected. But if it happens that everyone in your cohort lived longer, that's systematic mortality. And the GSA does not guarantee anything, and so it does not provide protection against systematic mortality improvements. And so it's imperative that when you price it in the annuity factors every year, you account for probable future mortality improvements, but just how much you should allow for. So this is an example of if you had priced in a level of future mortality improvements, but in actual fact, you get something more. Say, for example, medical advancements happen faster than you expected, or there's a magical cure for whatever disease that would have killed all the members that you hoped for. And so this happens. This is very interesting because the income that retirees receive don't decline straight away. It's actually fairly stable until about age 81 and 82 before it quickly declines. And these are just some of the insights of the basic type of selections that you may experience. And then we come to the question of open and closed pools. We know that an open pool is more efficient for pooling. But if you're in a closed pool and you can get a lot of members to join up front, it could also be a safe design. And we're going to take you through some of the scenarios that can happen in open and closed pool designs and work through what an individual retiree would experience and how they would choose between different pool designs. And we're going to take you through that. And the point of the presentation is that if you want to have an open pool, there are some things you can do and you can't do. And if you want a closed pool, there's something you can do and you can't do. And I assume we know what is an open and closed pool. An open pool is anyone can join at any time. You can't withdraw the money because if you withdraw money at any time, you kill the whole purpose of the GSA. Because if I thought, hey, I'm going to die next year, I'll just draw my money out. No one gets their mortality credit. The whole product collapses. So an open pool is really anyone can join at any time across any cohort. A closed pool is you want a group of people that meet certain criteria. So, for example, 65-year-olds at time zero this year. And then they can join throughout the year, but after the year ended, and if you haven't joined, you can't join. So that's what a closed pool is. And what we're going to show you is the interaction between open and closed pools and the investment strategies the pool would likely to engage in. And we ask ourselves, what if things happen? Because there is no guarantee, things can happen, and they directly affect the level of income retirees receive. So here's just some of the things that you may want to think about. So what if the investment market collapses. What if there's a depressed level of return consecutively over many years, what we experienced around the GSA? What if more or less people die? What's going to happen? And what if I don't join a GSA and I keep on self-annuitizing in my account-based pension? So what would happen? So firstly, I'd take you through the self-annuitization strategy in an account-based pension. So this graph assumes a 65-year-old male retiring, putting all of their money into an account-based pension, trying to smooth out their income over the years such that they don't run out of money until age 95. And you see the person probably receives around $5 a year, $5.50 a year, until age 95, and they start running out of money. And this graph shows you a cash investment strategy. And this graph shows you a balanced investment strategy. And so we can see that if you're self-annuitizing, common sense, you'd want to take advantage of better investment returns over the long term, with expected average payments up 17.3%. And we're just trying to see how that, so if you're a 65-year-old male, you had done that in the first how many years of your retirement, and then you were thinking about, should I join a GSA, assuming that there are open pools out there for you to join. That is, you can join at any time. So for the first 10 years, you've experienced the same investment environment as someone else in the GSA had for the first 10 years. And then you're thinking that I'm 75 now, I have a choice of going to a GSA or continue to self-annuitize. And if I go to a GSA, I can go to an existing cash-invested pool or a balance-invested pool. Or I can start my new pool if a new pool is better off for people like me. And if you're a 75-year-old in that situation, you'd be going through this thought process, and we'll show you what happens. So this first graph shows you a 75-year-old joining an existing cash pool, that is a pool of 65-year-olds at the time, just like you, but the other people, when they retire, they join a GSA, and it's a cash pool, it's an open cash pool. You had invested in the self-annuitized account-based pension, you experienced the same investment environment, and being cash or cash asset liability matched, this is what we would see. So the 75-year-old would experience about $9 on average over the years, stable average and median income. But we see that the characteristic of a GSA is that sometimes you run out of money, sometimes you get a lot of money, depending on the mortality experience and the investment experience. We already know that. And we compare that to the option of 75-year-olds trying to start their new cash pool. And what we see is that it's the two are fairly similar in terms of the average and median. There's a little bit of difference between them, and they're mostly in the volatility. And that is because we know that if you join an open pool, pooling is more efficient. And so what if then I decide to join an open pool that invested in a balanced investment strategy, and we're going to shock it with an investment shock just like the global financial crisis. So in the first 10 years of your retirement, the market tanked and you experienced 3 years of substandard investment returns. So you experienced that in your first 10 years in the account-based pension. The people in the open GSA pool experienced that in their first 10 years. And we see, if you're a 75-year-old, are you going to join an open pool or are you going to start your new pool? And you're going to make that choice by virtue of how much money I'm going to get going forward. So this graph shows you what happens if you join an existing balanced pool. And that is what you'll get So this is an existing balanced pool, this is a new balanced pool. So you're starting that off when you're 75 with other 75-year-olds at the same time. So this, you're joining an existing pool. And what we see is we see this option being much better than this option. So if you're a 75-year-old after an investment shock, you'd rather start your own pool with other 75-year-olds rather than joining an existing GSA pool. And that's a very insightful learning, in that if you're a GSA provider and if you want an open pool design, you can't really afford to invest in risky assets, because if you do and the investment market tanks, new people joining the pool would be dissuaded by the level of mortality credits they're going to receive in the future, because all of the people that were in the GSA had experienced a bad return in the first how many years of the existence of the GSA. So you would rather start your own pool. But if it's cash, we see that you're indifferent. And if you want more efficient pooling, you would go and join an existing pool. Now we take you to examples of not only investment returns being substandard, but also the pool had experienced more or less deaths in the first 10 years. Again, you're a 75-year-old male, you've self-annuitized in the first 10 years, and other people have been in the GSA for the first 10 years, and you're faced with a choice of which GSA fund you're going to join. So this is an example of an existing pool invested in a balanced asset allocation and experienced higher deaths than normal, than average. And so you would see that if you're a 75-year-old, your median income every year is forecast to decline. Whereas in this example, another pool being exactly the same pool, invested in exactly the same assets, but they experienced lower deaths in the first 10 years, you see that in this pool, according to the mathematics and distribution formulas, you being a 75-year-old, you would have increasing income every year after age 75. And so what this tells you, if you're a 75-year-old, you'd rather join this pool and not that pool. And that's an example of selection and the interactions between investment experience and mortality experience of the pool. And so if you're trying to do an open pool, there are some things you should be wary of how people choose to join your pool. Because if you set it up in such a way that potentially dissuade people from joining your pool, you're not going to get the benefit of efficient pooling, of being in an open pool. Instead, what you would get is you would get many new pools popping up, because the new people, the new cohorts, think that that design is better off for them. Whereas in a closed pool, you don't have all those issues. What you lose is you lose the efficiency in pooling. You can invest in balanced assets because no one has the option of joining the pool after 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, which means you can just go and invest in whatever you want to invest in, and the pool takes care of itself. However, to ensure efficient pooling, from previous literature, we know that you have to have enough members up front for a closed pool design to be efficient. So we've taken you through some of the design considerations of a GSA, and we're going to quickly go through some of the other retiree considerations that may have. For example, household formation. All of the modelling that we've done have assumed a single male of 65-year-old male. We know that most people live in a household of two people, and the joint mortality experience is going to affect your choices as well. Secondly is the bequest motive. We know that if you put your money in a GSA and if you die, the pool inherits your money, not your family. Some people, or most people out there, are risk averse and they have a bequest motive. And how exactly is the bequest motive going to affect take up in the GSA? That's a question. Thirdly, is very important, communicating the value proposition. A GSA is not a simple product compared to other products out there, for example, the account-based pension. And so there is a role for financial advisors or everyone of us to play to educate the public on how a GSA works. And that contributes to a lack of awareness at the moment of GSAs. There is also a common criticism of the GSA that, yes, on average you provide a higher return, a higher income than other products. However, there is no guarantee on the minimum payment. So what if experience turns out to be against my favour and I receive less money than I should have? And so this is just a simple graph showing you that you being a retired person investing in a GSA is most of the time going to give you a better return than an account-based pension. And we see that up until age 95 and 96, more than 95% of the time, you're going to have better returns than an account-based pension. But again, this graph doesn't take into account of a bequest motive, that if you had died early before age 95, your money would have gone to the pool in a GSA, but to your family in the account-based pension. And the last point is flexibility. The GSA is not designed to give people that much flexibility compared to the account-based pension. As we have seen in the graph earlier, the triangle, the GSA is really trying to balance a lot of the considerations that retirees have. Flexibility, level of income and risk management. And these are just some of the factors we have to think about going forward when we think about offering GSAs and taking up GSAs. Now we open up for questions.
Michael Burt, I feel I must challenge one of your slides, which says that GSAs are not appropriate for smokers. I think that's untrue. GSAs are not appropriate for smokers if they're mixed with the general population. But if you have a smoker-only GSA, then it's a perfectly viable product.
The comment on that one, though, is that I will claim to be a smoker then to get some of those payments as well. And I've also got really bad lung cancer and asbestosis and everything else, so let me in.
It's a problem that life insurers have to deal with at the moment, I believe. I'm not a life insurance expert, but there are, I believe, tests for whether you are a smoker or not, if you want to go that far. Look, I appreciate there are some issues, but to actually say that they're insurmountable, I think, is probably going a bit too far.
It wasn't so much the smoking per se, but just the concept that someone who is actually not necessarily a smoker, but actually gravely ill at 65... they've got less than 5 years to live, they're not going to go into a GSA, yet all the modelling has assumed that they will take it up because we're getting population mortality. So from a modelling point of view, you need to reduce the expectation of what the payments could be because you're not going to have these early departures from that. And then given that everyone knows it's a bit like the old ongoing game theory, is that given everyone knows it's, you know, people who think they're going to die in 1 year are not going to be in there. The people who worry about 2 and 3 are going to opt out as well, which is the same as the, you know, part of the annuitisation puzzle as it exists now.
Oh, look, I'll concede the selection point, but to say that it's, how could it, death to smokers, probably not the right phrase, but is probably a little too far. I mean, it obviously would require a lot more thought about the product design, but it's not impossible to offer a GSA that may be attractive to parts of the population that have below average life expectancy.
Yeah, I think the main point there is you've got to get it right, because if you don't get it right, you end up with this, that if you think you're going to get more smokers or less smokers than you do, your mortality experience is going to be different to expectation, and on average, the income experience that people have over time won't be very smooth.
Tony Boffinger, is this on? I just wanted to add another consideration to your list, which is volatility of payments, because I think the box and whiskers charts can sometimes be a bit misleading about what the volatility is, because somebody assumes that they're just going to follow one of those nice smooth points. But the way you get to the median point at, you know, age year 20 or whatever could actually be something that moves around a lot more. So particularly in a balanced portfolio, you're not going to get that level of smoothness.
Yeah, absolutely agree. So if you see this is the median line, sometimes you can bounce up and down. And I think that's one of the features of the GSA, in that you get what you get. There's no guarantee. There is no guaranteed level of minimum income. But the trade-off is, because there is no guarantee, there is no need to hold capital. You just hold the investment fees, withhold the investment fees from the income. And on average, in theory, that's going to give you a higher average return.
I'd also add that there's another session running at the moment looking at utility functions, and the way you actually capture the impact of that variability is to define an appropriate utility function for up and down, which we haven't attempted to do here because they're usually mathematical simplifications.
I should have just said. Yes, so unfortunately I missed that session. We just need to bear in mind that an individual experiences what the individual experiences. And so, playing out, looking at averages, looking at medians and quartiles and all that is very, very good for an understanding point of view. But what an individual actually gets is a particular outcome. And if they look at that chart and say, well, you know, I could go like that or I could go like that, what they're not getting is, even within that, they're jumping around. That's all my point is.
Hi there, Henry Costa. Charles, question for you. Based on all this work and research that you've done, if we go back to that triangle, the trilemma of flexibility, income and guarantee risk management, based on all the work you've done, what sort of allocation to a GSA or more in general annuity would you suggest is appropriate or optimal to actually get a good mix of what the members might want and need?
Oh dear. Without giving...
It's not all or nothing, which is what that triangle suggests, but a lot of the analysis has been presented today as a little bit of all or nothing.
Yeah, definitely. It really depends on your personal preference and your personal circumstances, I think.
I could add, if you go back the Hanapal paper that referenced, she actually, in the same context there, I can't remember which one was 30, 35, there were two 35s and one 30, and I can't remember which one was actually the 30. I think it was the GSA was the 30, and 35, 35, which is, call it a third, a third, a third. In some sense, it's not very scientific, but that fell out of her maths. I suspect it'd be all up to the individual in terms of what they want. And certainly when we look at sort of what our clients are actually doing in their adoption of how much they use the annuities, that does vary up and down depending on their needs in that basis there. So I would expect to see a big range of what's there, but starting point of equal mix as being not a bad start.
Yeah, and I think that goes to Tony's point as well, that you know the GSA has a role, the annuity has a role, the account-based pension has a role to play.
It's Jeff Atkins. One question and one observation. Do you guys think this can fly for Australian retirement incomes market?
Oh, there is no reason why it can't fly. I mean... If we look at the triangle, the GSA is a different type of product addressing a different need, and it fills a gap in the product mix. So the account-based pension gives you flexibility, the traditional annuity gives you risk management, and GSA tries to be somewhere out here, gives you higher income. And so if you're a retiree, depending on your tastes and preferences, definitely the GSA has a role to play. And if there are people buying it and people selling it. Would you like to add to that, Aaron?
As you're probably aware, I'm slightly conflicted to answer that question. But from a personal viewpoint on this is that if you're looking at the benefit out of the GSA here is the higher income, moving from the mindset, and there's a strong mindset that's happened because we've had, 20-odd fantastic years of share market returns, that equities are the solution for everything. We're going to live longer, put more in equities. I'm worried about inflation, put more in equities. And that's sort of, everyone's sort of sitting up with this account-based pension. Now, from a system point of view, I actually think there's too much structural risk within that. So moving away from, let's all just bet on equities and we'll get there, I see a big role for the bottom of the triangle to have a bigger play. Now, personal view is that there'll be some people that want the risk off the table. There'll be some people that'll be happy to take some of that on. With where we are, we're so far away from just everyone understanding the equity risk that actually sits there. And you look in the context of the last 20 years versus the last 50, 60, that people don't actually recall. People don't remember why equities were unloved through the 80s because they were such a poor performer. So in that sense there, I think we're a few steps away before we'll see a lot of movement down here. But I do think that ultimately that triangle is the way to go.
Thanks. When I was being educated about this, mainly by my friend Peter Martin, it became apparent that the inherent complexity is a very important issue, given the relative lack of this sort of financial literacy amongst most of the superannuation membership. One of the conclusions we came to was that we would have to quite radically change our disclosure obligations and our risk disclosures. And one of the ways that it was suggested that this be done was by inviting or perhaps requiring super fund trustees to make an offer of a post-retirement solution that they regarded as suitable for their members. So it comes from the concept of default, but it's not a default because you still have to choose to go in. You don't go in if you say nothing. So there's a fair bit of, broader design work about the customer interface and really picking up on a lot of the behavioural finance stuff in order to make it work in the marketplace. And if you forgive me, one really brief last comment. The industry funds are today's mutual life insurers. And over the long haul, mutual life insurers have disappeared from our economy, by and large. So I just find myself speculating about how and when the new mutuals might find that the mutual structure is not effective for them and where they might go.
David Knox, and I guess I have to declare a conflict of interest. As many of you would know, offered a GSA type product, but that's another session after lunch. My comment though is more about this triangle. You've looked at the GSA in the high income corner. I actually think it also helps the risk management feature because it's actually pooling longevity or pooling mortality risk. So it's not only in the high income space, but it's actually handling some of the longevity risk that retirees face, which annuities do in a different way, but I think GSAs also help that.
I'll give that to you, David. The concept, if you think about the far corner here, has all the risk managed. The GSA is targeting higher income by moving along. It may not get all, doesn't leave all the risk off the table, but depending on your model. Like, I know your own product takes the investment risk out of it, so as you can leave your account-based pension and earning cash, no risk, you can take investment risk out that way there. Maybe it doesn't get quite there, but in the mix, I don't know what would be over this way, that's not flexible, has no risk and is only income, aside from something by Bernie Madoff, which I don't really think we want in the system.
Yeah, I think the a GSA doesn't pull systematic longevity risk, so it's just idiosyncratic. So in terms of the risk management features, a traditional annuity would give you more risk management. However, the trade-off is, yeah, you do get higher income. Yeah, I agree.
Adam Butt, thanks for the presentation, guys. It was really interesting. I'm a little concerned that we're lumping in the cash version and the balance version in together because they seem to have very, very different characteristics in terms of the income they generate for retirees and the drivers of those income, of that income. So the balanced option seems to me to be very driven by the returns that are actually generated on the underlying portfolio, whereas perhaps the cash version is more driven by the mortality experience of the population. I was just wondering if you had any comments on that at all.
Yeah, a balanced version, you'll get more income, definitely. And if you think about the income goes to the balance of the retiree in the pool, and if they die, they forfeit that balance to the pool, which means everyone else gets a higher mortality credit. And so the interaction is, yeah, if you get more return, you know, everyone, the whole pool's better off. But the cash version, of course, you get more more stable returns.
That's right. I'd add, I don't think we actually lump them together. We're trying to compare what they look like differently. So you get a different view if you have an asset matched or cash strategy than if you've got a riskier investment mix, and that has an impact.
Jonathan Sheed from State Street. Thanks. Terrific presentation. As someone who doesn't work in the insurance industry, I was really excited to see these kind of products come along, and I think there are a couple of opportunities for us as a profession. The first is the fact that there isn't capital and there isn't an insurer, I think, is a tremendous opportunity for the profession. We're witnessing a great disintermediation and great disenfranchisement of financial institutions, and this is an opportunity for us as a profession to say to retirees, if you want to share experience with your fellow retirees, this is a way of doing it. And I actually think there's a powerful message here that the profession can deliver. And retirees are a lot more sophisticated than I think we often give them credit. The second comment I'd make is that a lot of the discussion in financial planning world is about how you generate income, quote, end quote. And I think that leads to distortions between what's capital and what's income, and we have an opportunity of developing something or promoting something that doesn't lead to those distortions. The thing that concerns me, and part of my role in my job, I find, is often to be the guy who is going to tell you what can go wrong. And the thing that concerns me is in build-up phase or in rundown phase of a product, you might only have 200 lives sign up in a closed pool before you have to close the doors, or you might have a provider who's only got 150 lives left in the pool when they go out of business or cease to sponsor something. That's 150 potential headlines, and if there's no capital there, what do you do about that? So I'd be interested in your thoughts about, in the ramp-up stage or the potential rundown stage, what can go wrong, how do you deal with it?
Yeah, and I think the idea of a GSA is, in the decumulation phase, is similar to a DC fund in the accumulation phase. So, you know, I put my money there at age 65. In 35 years, when I'm 95, the fund disappeared. I think some of the... It's not more risky than a DC fund from a management point of view, I think.
I'd just add, thinking about the concept here about whether you get it is a problem, and it's a bit like a chicken or the egg, and I'm sure David's sort of been through this with thinking about the stuff there. You do need some level of critical mass to get it up and running. Having an open system and having a structure, you know, where, as with, you know, an annuity book could be transferred, where you could transfer the management of one of these things to pull the lives at the back end, from a regulatory point of view, I think will be important. You know, this is not, you know, open slather, sort of just open up a shingle and here you go, here's a GSA and have 50 people in it. It will need to be large, structured, regulated entities, you know, at least managing and designing it and putting it together there. You know, APRA and super funds fit that bill in my book, so there's hope.
The final bell's just about to ring. Might have time for just one quick question to close out.
Peter Martin, just a technical question on the modelling of the selection risk, where the income profile just dropped off. Yep, so it looks to me like that's a set and forget system. So you've set the payout factors at time zero and ignore the emerging experience of the pool. Did you look at a different approach which would see the payout factors reacting to the experience as it unfolded? And if you did, how long did it take before you could recognise that the experience of the pool was different from what was behind the payout factors?
Yeah, so
you have a quick response.
Okay, so yeah, this modelling we did actually take into account of that. So the model, the pricing learns the experience, but there's always a lag. So we assumed about a 2 to 3 year lag between what you've seen and what you've assumed. But unfortunately, reality always happens faster than your expectation in this example.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'm sure if you have more questions, Aaron and Chow will be happy to take them after the session. In the meantime, please thank them for their very thought-provoking presentation.